content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article today is entitled, Tree of Life Rabbi and Mother Emmanuel Pastor, 7 years of a friendship forged in tragedy. This was written by Bob Smetana. When the Reverend Eric Manning arrived in New York for a recent speaking engagement, a friendly face was waiting for him. As he walked off the plane, there was his friend, Rabbi Hazen Jeffrey Myers. "Somebody might say it's not a big deal," said Manning. "It's a big deal to me." On October 27th marked the 7-year anniversary of the mass shooting at Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, where Myers is the rabbi and cantor. And this week marks the 7th anniversary of Myers and Manning's unlikely friendship, one that has led both men to believe that love is stronger than the hate that seeks to divide us. On October 27th of 2018, a gunman opened fire at Tree of Life, killing 11 members of the congregation, a day that still haunts Myers. A few days after the shooting, as Myers was sorting through the thousands of emails that came in after the tragedy, a message with the headline of Charleston popped up. He clicked on the email and found a message from Manning, the pastor of Mother Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, a congregation with its own history of tragedy. Manning's message was simple, "I'm coming to town." At first, Myers said he was reluctant to respond, saying he did not have the energy to meet with one more stranger in the midst of trying to help his congregation cope with loss and grief. "Something told me I need to sit down and meet with this man," Myers told the audience at Religion News Services Symposium, God, Government, and the Algorithm, New Rules of Belief and Power, at Trinity Commons in New York City on October 22nd. The two met for hours in a restaurant, sipping coffee and talking. It was a relief to speak with someone who knew what Myers and his congregation were going through. "I learned this wonderful phrase called the Ministry of Presence," Myers said. Manning had become pastor at Mother Emmanuel in 2016, while that congregation was still reeling from the 2015 murder of 9 church members of the historically black congregation during a Wednesday evening Bible study. Among those killed by a white supremacist was the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, the church's pastor, leaving a void that several short-term pastors had tried to fill. When he arrived at Mother Emmanuel, Manning said there was no roadmap for helping a congregation heal. He knew Myers might be overwhelmed and wanted to offer a listening ear and whatever help he could. The two men came from different faith traditions, but the challenge of leading a congregation in tragedy was the same. Myers ended up inviting Manning to read the 23rd Psalm at the funeral for one of the members of Tree of Life and offered a few words, opening the door for a relationship between the two congregations. When the trial came for the Tree of Life shooter, Manning was there, sitting beside Myers' wife as the rabbi told the story of what he experienced that day, with details he had never told in public before. "It was a kindness," the rabbi said, "he would never forget." "He sat and held my wife during the testimony. I couldn't look at her. It was hard enough to get through the testimony," he said. "I'll be eternally grateful to this beautiful human being." At the symposium, held less than a week before the 7th anniversary of the Tree of Life attack, Myers recounted the shock and horror of watching the attack unfold. "Many of those killed were older members who had arrived early for services. I couldn't save them," he said. "There were a few I hustled out the front, but I was the last person to see them alive. I carry with me for the rest of my life survivor's remorse." Myers said he now feels a calling to help others heal from tragedy and to testify that there is still good in the world, even in the face of tragedy. He and Manning have reached out to faith leaders at other congregations affected by mass shootings and said they are always willing to pack a bag and go wherever there is a need. I have said before that when God calls, you don't send God to voicemail, Myers said. Instead, you answer the call and do what God asks. During their talk, the two faith leaders asked reporters and other media to look for the good in the world. Manning asked what might happen if news outlets began the day with 90 seconds of good news before launching into the bad. Pick up the story that someone met someone else along the way and showed them compassion when they didn't have to, he said. How would that change our narrative? The faith leaders said the tragedy brought them together, but love kept them together. They said faith leaders and other leaders needed to model the values they want to see in the world, and they hope their example will permit others to make similar friends and to show kindness. They both believe there is more good in the world than evil, and that the world events cannot shake their friendship. Myers used a bit of humor to contrast the enduring power of spiritual values like love to the changing realities of politics. The changing landscape of the world doesn't impact the core values, which are hard and fast, because geopolitical currents change every day like undergarments, he said. They just change at will, but the core values stick. Manning agreed. What takes place in the world takes place in the world. I don't know all the folks in the world, but I know him, Manning said, pointing to Myers. We are friends. We love each other. Well, that last story was a little bit hard for me to read. I kept breaking up as I was reading it. Our second story, Building a Stable Abode of Thought, Kant's Rules for Virtuous Thinking. And this is by Alexander T. Engelert, who is an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Richmond. And this is part of Religious News Service known as The Conversation, this article. What makes a life virtuous? The answer might seem simple. Virtuous actions, actions that align with morality. But life is more than doing. Frequently, we just think. We observe and spectate, meditate and contemplate. Life often unfolds in our heads. As a philosopher, I specialize in the Enlightenment thinker, Immanuel Kant, who had volumes, literally, to say about virtuous actions. What I find fascinating, however, is that Kant also believed people can think virtuously and should. To do so, he identified three simple rules listed and explained in his 1790 book, Critique and the Power of Judgment. Namely, think for yourself, think in the position of everyone else, and finally, think in harmony with yourself. If followed, he thought a communal sense could result, improving mutual understanding and helping people appreciate how their ideas relate to others' ideas. Given our current world with its post-truth culture and isolated echo chambers, I believe Kant's lessons in virtuous thinking offer important tools today. Rule 1. Think for yourself. Thinking can be both active and passive. We can choose where to direct our attention and use reason to solve problems or consider why things happen. Still, we cannot completely control our stream of thought. Feelings and ideas bubble up from influences outside our control. One kind of passive thinking is letting others think for us. Such passive thinking, Kant thought, was not good for anybody. When we accept someone else's argument without a second thought, it is like handing them the wheel to think for us. But thoughts lie at the foundation of who we are and what we do. Thus, we should be aware of abdicating control. Kant had a word for handing over the wheel, heteronomy, or surrendering freedom to another authority. For him, virtue depended on the opposite, autonomy, or the ability to determine our own principles of action. The same principle holds true for thinking, Kant wrote. We have an obligation to take responsibility for our own thinking and to check its overarching validity and soundness. In Kant's day, he was especially concerned about superstition, since it provides consoling, oversimplified answers to life's problems. Today, superstition is still widespread, but many new pernicious forms of trying to control thought now proliferate. Thanks to the generative artificial intelligence and the amount of time we spend online, the rise of deepfakes, the use of ChatGPT for creative tasks, and information ecosystems that block out opposing views are but a few examples. Kant's rule number one tells us to approach content and opinions cautiously. Healthy skepticism provides a buffer and leaves room for reflection. In short, active or autonomous thinking protects people from those who seek to think for them. Rule 2. Think in the position of everyone else. Pride often tempts us to believe that we have everything figured out. Rule 2 checks this pride. Kant recommends what philosophers call epistemic humility, or humility about our own knowledge. Stepping outside our own beliefs isn't just about opening up to new perspectives. It's also the bedrock of science, which seeks shared agreement about what is and is not true. Suppose you're in a meeting and a consensus is taking shape. Strong personalities in a quorum support it, but you remain unsure. At this point, Rule 2 does not recommend that you adopt the view of the others. Quite the opposite, in fact. If you simply accept the group's conclusion without further thought, you'd be breaking rule number one, think for yourself. Instead, rule two prescribes temporarily detaching yourself from even your own way of thinking, especially your own biases. It's an opportunity to think in the position of everyone else. What would a fair and discerning thinker make of this situation? Kant believed that, while difficult, a standpoint can be reached in which biases all but vanish. We might notice things that we missed before, but this requires appreciating our own limitations and seeking a wider, more universal view. Again, Kant's view of virtue depends on autonomy, so Rule 2 isn't about letting others think for us. To be responsible for how we shape the world, we must take responsibility for our own thinking, since everything flows from that point outward. But it emphasizes the communal part of the communal sense, reminding us that it is possible to share what is true. Rule 3. Think in harmony with yourself. The final rule Kant maintained is both the most difficult and profound. He said that it is the task of becoming Einsteinig, literally of one voice, with ourselves. He also uses a related term, consequent, coherent, to express the same idea. To clarify, a metaphor that Kant employed can help, namely carpentry. Constructing a building is complex. The blueprint must be sound, the building materials must be high quality, and craftsmanship matters. If the nails are hammered sloppily or steps performed out of order, then the edifice might collapse. Rule 3 tells us to construct our abode of thought with the same care as when constructing a house, such that stability between the parts results. Each thought, belief, and intention is a building block. To be einstimmig or bündig, to be in harmony, these building blocks should fit well together and support each other. Imagine a colleague who you believe has impeccable taste. You trust his opinions, but one day he shares his secret obsession with death metal music, a genre you dislike. A disharmony in thought might result. Your reaction to his love of death metal reveals a further belief. Your belief that only people with disturbed taste could love something you perceive to be so grating to the spirit. But he seems otherwise like such a thoughtful and pleasant person. Rather than immediately change your belief about him, Kant's third rule commands you to investigate the world and your own thoughts further. Perhaps you have never listened to death metal with a discerning spirit. Maybe your original beliefs about your colleague were inaccurate. Or could it be that having good taste is more complex than you originally thought? Rule 3 leads us to do a system check of our mental architecture. Whether you're considering music, politics, morality, or religion. And if that architecture is stable, Kant thinks that rewards will follow. Sure, harmony is satisfying, but that's not all. A sturdy system of thought might equip us better for the integrated creative thinking. When I understand how things connect, my own control over them can improve. For example, insight about human psychology will open up new ways to think about morality, and vice versa. But ultimately, Kant found harmony important because it supports the construction of a coherent worldview. The English language gained that term through the translation of a German word, Weltanschauung, which Kant coined, and which has been the focus of my own work. At its most basic, a harmonious worldview allows us to feel more at home in the world. We gain a sense of how it hangs together and see it as imbued with meaning. How we think ultimately determines how we live. If we have a stable abode of thought, we take that stability into everything we do and have some shelter from life's storms. I'm going to try to pronounce that German word one more time, Weltanschauung, which is worldview, a coherent worldview. Our third story, the Erie Canal, how a big ditch transformed America's economy, culture, and even religion. Written by Matthew Smith, visiting assistant professor of history from Miami at Miami University. 200 years ago, on October 26, 1825, New York Governor DeWitt Clinton boarded a canal boat by the shores of Lake Erie. Amid boisterous festivities, his vessel, the Seneca Chief, embarked from Buffalo, the westernmost port of his brand new Erie Canal. Clinton and his flotilla made their way east to the canal's terminus in Albany, then down the Hudson River to New York City. This maiden voyage culminated on November 4th with a ceremonial disgorging of barrels full of Lake Erie water into the brine of the Atlantic. Pure political theater, he called the Wedding of the Waters. The Erie Canal, whose bicentennial is being celebrated all month, is an engineering marvel, a national historic monument enshrined in folk song. Such was its legacy that as a young politician, Abraham Lincoln dreamed of becoming the DeWitt Clinton of Illinois. As a historian of the 19th century frontier, I'm fascinated by how civil engineering shaped America, especially given the country's struggles to fix its aging infrastructure today. The opening of the Erie Canal reached beyond Clinton's Empire State, cementing the Midwest into the prosperity of the growing nation. This human-made waterway transformed America's economy and immigration while helping fuel a passionate religious revival. But like most big achievements, getting there wasn't easy. The nation's first superhighway was almost dead on arrival. The idea of connecting New York City to the Great Lakes originated in the late 18th century, yet when Clinton pushed to build a canal, the plan was controversial. The governor and his supporters secured funding through Congress in 1817, but President James Madison vetoed the bill, considering federal support for a state project unconstitutional. New York turned to state bonds to finance the project, which Madison's ally Thomas Jefferson had derided as madness. Some considered Clinton's big ditch blasphemy. If the Lord had intended there should be internal waterways, argued Quaker minister Elias Hicks, he would have placed them there. Construction began on July 4th of 1817. Completed 8 years later, the canal stretched some 363 miles with 18 aqueducts and 83 locks to compensate for elevation changes en route. All this was built with only basic tools, pack animals, and human muscle, the latter supplied by some 9,000 laborers, roughly one quarter of whom were recent immigrants from Ireland. Despite its naysayers, the Erie Canal paid off, literally. Within a few years, shipping rates from Lake Erie to New York City fell from $100 a ton to under $9. Annual freight on the canal eclipsed trade along the Mississippi River within a few decades, amounting to $200 million, which would be more than $8 billion today. Commerce drove industry and immigration, enriching the canal towns of New York, transforming villages like Syracuse and Utica into cities. From 1825 to 1835, Rochester, New York, was the fastest-growing urban center in America. By the 1830s, politicians had stopped ridiculing America's growing canal system. It was making too much money. A hefty $7 million investment in building the Erie Canal had been fully recouped in toll fees alone. Nor was its legacy simply economic. Like many Americans during the Industrial Revolution, New Yorkers struggled to find stability, purpose, and community. The Erie Canal channeled new ideas and religious movements, including the Second Great Awakening, a nationwide movement of Christian evangelism and social reform, partly in reaction to the upheavals of a changing economy. Though the movement began at the turn of the century, it flourished in the hinterlands along the Erie Canal, which became known as the Burned Over District. Revivalists like Charles Grandison Finney, America's most famous preacher at the time, found a lively reception among this psychic highway, as one author later dubbed upstate New York. Some denominations, like the Methodists, grew dramatically, but the Burned Over District also gave birth to new churches after the canal's creation. Joseph Smith founded the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, often known as Mormons, in Fayette, New York, in 1830. The teachings of William Miller, who lived near the Vermont border, spread west along the canal route, the roots of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. As Clinton predicted, the Erie Canal was a bond of union between the Atlantic and Western states, uniting upstate New York and the agrarian frontier of the Midwest to the urban markets of the Eastern Seaboard. In the mid-1820s, Ohio Governor Ethan Allen Brown praised America's canals as veins and arteries to the body politic and commissioned two canals of his own, one to link the Ohio River to the Erie Canal, completed in 1832, and another to link the Miami River, completed in 1845. These canals, in turn, connected to numerous smaller waterways, creating an extensive network of trade and transportation. Like New York, Ohio had its canal towns, including Middletown, the birthplace of Vice President J.D. Vance, and a city emblematic of America's shifting industrial fortunes. While America's canal boom brought prosperity, this wealth came at a cost to many indigenous communities, a cost that is only slowly being acknowledged. The Haudenosaunee, often known by the name Iroquois, especially paid the price for the Erie Canal. The Confederacy of Tribes was pressured into ceding lands to the state of New York and further displaced by ensuing frontier settlement. As the U.S. nears its 250th birthday on July 4, 2026, the official website of this commemoration urges Americans to pause and reflect on our nation's past and to look ahead toward the future we want to create for the next generation and beyond. As the recent federal government shutdown suggests, however, the nation's political system is struggling. Overcoming gridlock demands bipartisan consensus on basic concerns. Technology changes, but the demands of infrastructure, from rebuilding roads and bridges to expanding broadband and sustainable energy networks, and the will needed to address them persist. As the Erie Canal reminds us, American democracy has always been built upon concrete foundations. I'm only going to be able to read excerpts of this next article due to time constraints. It's entitled, How Zohan Mamdani's Campaign Will Change Perceptions of Muslims. At the start of early voting in New York, beginning a historic election would determine whether frontrunner Zohan Mamdani will become the city's first Muslim mayor. The Imam Latif's sermon also called on those gathered to learn about Mamdani's campaign, which had withstood vitriolic and vile Islamophobic attacks from his opponent, the former Governor Andrew Cuomo, Republican U.S. Representative Elise Stefanik, and others in recent weeks. While New York is home to the largest Jewish population outside of Israel, it is also home to the largest Muslim population in the United States. Mamdani's joy-filled campaign should not be seen as a negation of another group's place in city politics, but an inflection point for those often unseen Muslim New Yorkers. I'll have to read that entire article next time because we've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina.